please. Call the case of State of Texas against Ernest Lynn Ross.
May it please the court, Ms. Lynn arguing for the state and Mr. Nick Meyer arguing for appellate.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Andrea Simmons, and I am representing the State of Texas on behalf of Denton County in this case today. The fact of this case, the issue in this case, is a motion to suppress that was filed by the appellee pre-trial regarding a search of the vehicle, a trunk of the vehicle, suitcases inside the vehicle. The trial court in this case denied the motion to suppress all evidence except for the evidence that was recovered from a locked suitcase found within the trunk of the vehicle. And the facts of this case stem primarily from a confidential informant. The informant was a member of a group of men who were getting together and finding victims, conducting surveillance on those victims, following them to their homes, and conducting home invasions and robbing individuals. One of the men, the informant in this case, worked with the police to help the police bust the group of men on a home invasion they were planning in Denton County. The police arrested all of the members of the group just prior to them leaving a predetermined location to go commit the home invasion in Denton County. And at that time, the appellee and another man were located in a silver Mercedes, which is a car that the informant had told us previously that appellee drove, and which the police had corroborated that he had been seen multiple occasions in the same vehicle.
Excuse me, were they all found at this Walmart parking lot, or were there two separate locations?
It was one location at a Walmart parking lot. There were four men, two came in one vehicle and two in another, and they were meeting there with all of their goal was to meet there with their supplies and stuff and get their disguises on, and they had a truck with a hydraulic lift there at the Walmart they were picking up because they were hoping to use that to remove a safe that they had determined was in the home they were heading to. And based on other information that had been corroborated by our confidential informant, we were also under the police officers involved in this case were also aware that the appellee and these other gentlemen were also going to be having firearms and possibly explosive devices, especially considering the house they were going to was going to have a safe. When the police arrested appellee and the other men from there, they then conducted a search of the vehicle. They began with the interior of the vehicle, moved to the trunk of the vehicle. There were containers or suitcases in the back of that, and all of the suitcases were opened. One of those suitcases was locked. The key to that suitcase, however, was located on the key ring that was in the ignition of the vehicle, so no force was used in opening the locked suitcase found within the trunk of the vehicle. The trial court in this case found that the informant was reliable and credible and that the search was valid pursuant to the information that officers at the scene had pertaining to firearms and explosives. He found that the search of the vehicle was proper, the trunk, and all of the suitcases except for the locked suitcase. He said at that point that he didn't believe that the probable cause extended that far because the Denton police should have had a bomb squad if they truly believed that explosives were in that suitcase.
So wasn't he really saying the exigent circumstances apparently did not exist in the trial court's mind?
As to the locked suitcase only. But he specifically held that exigent circumstance, I mean, he said that because of firearms and explosives, that the search of the car and the trunk and the suitcases was proper, and then somehow drew a line that unlocked suitcases versus locked suitcases was the difference on what the officers were going to be able to open. The state would argue that exigent circumstances are going to, if the exigent circumstances existed for the vehicle, the trunk of the vehicle, and the unlocked suitcases, then they surely it also applied to the locked suitcase as long as that suitcase is of something that could have held the explosives that have the basis for these exigent circumstances. There's nothing in the record to show that there's no reason that this specific suitcase could not have contained explosives. In fact, it contained multiple things. So clearly it was capable of holding explosives if there was probable cause that explosives could have been in the car.
So why didn't you go get a warrant?
Well, I think that the warrant situation, it was really not in the record why we didn't get a warrant, other than when the bust occurred, we had these officers there, we had ATF agents on the scene, and that the it just, because of it was in a public parking lot, of a Walmart parking lot at 8 o'clock in the evening on a Monday, it was quite busy, and the officers on the scene felt that they could not, that they needed to secure the vehicle and its contents immediately and look for these firearms and explosives. And they also were planning on impounding the vehicle, but were afraid to impound the vehicle due to the possibility of explosives.
Ms. Simmons?
Yes, sir.
What period of time lapsed between the time that the confidential informant provided information to police officer and sheriff's officer and the actual incident?
Yes, sir. And that is a pretty good question. All of this happened within a couple of days, although the actual predetermined location of where this bust was going to occur was not known to the officers. From my understanding of the case, it happened on the same day as the bust was going to occur. And it appears that same day that the officers had met with the confidential informant that day, he said he was meeting with appellee that afternoon. They were going to be discussing the Denton County home invasion. The officer followed him to a gas station, gave him the recording, audio recording again for the confidential informant, and the officer followed the confidential informant where he met with the appellee in this case. The two drove around, they discussed the home invasion, and basically, from my understanding, confirmed at that point that this was going to happen, and here's what the exact plan is. At that point, officers assisted in locating a hydraulic lift truck that the appellee was supposed to be providing to the men. And they also set up surveillance at the Walmart and prepared for the bust. There's no information on why they did not obtain a warrant other than they were getting as many of their forces available for that bust, including ATF agents, to protect the people of that area.
Well, if there was time to get two ATF agents, why wasn't there time enough to get a warrant?
Again, I'm not sure how much of the record will show. There was some confusion between the officers who were acting in this case on when they were going to conduct the bust, and I'm assuming that may have been part of determining whether or not to get a warrant or where to get a warrant for. They weren't sure if they were going to get them at the Walmart store, if they were going to stop them in route, or if they were going to wait for the men to get to the home that they were planning on robbing that evening. And so I think there was a lot of speculation, and from the record it appears that it was pretty unsure up until the time that this actually happened of where should we do this, how are we going to do it. And I'm assuming that the warrant in that situation wasn't done because the officers were at the last minute still trying to determine what the best area was for their safety and public safety to try to take these men down without injuring anyone. Of course, I think they could have, the charges would have been worse had they waited for these men to get to the home they were going to rob, and at that same time, you're putting those people's lives in jeopardy at that situation, and so these officers had to make a determination on a fairly quick basis of who's, what's the safest place to do this and how are we going to do it.
Thank you.
I think basically if the trial court were going to find that the confidential informant was reliable and credible and that the information relating to explosives was also reliable and that it extends to the vehicle, the trunk, and the unlocked suitcases, it therefore follows that it follows that it also applies to the locked suitcase, especially when you consider that no force was taken to open that vehicle and the key was right there for officers to unlock it and thus secure the area.
Did I miss something, but we didn't go to trial?
We have not had a trial in this case, but this is a pretrial motion to suppress. The trial is actually set October the 19th, I believe, at this point, but we're pending appeal at this point. And I would also like to direct this court's attention that the warrantless search has to be justified by what officers knew at the inception of the search and not what they found after the search. So the reasonable officer and a prudent officer at this time, if the search occurred and the bust was occurring, would have acted reasonably in securing the vehicle, making sure there were no explosives in the vehicle and determine what the next step would have been considering the public area of the Walmart parking lot. The trial court actually, his finding for not allowing us into the locked suitcase said that he said there wasn't a lot of danger to the public. The suspects were under arrest, and if they believed, police officers believed there was a bomb, that prudence would have dictated a bomb squad. And that reasoning, however, fails if you also find that in the same breath, he said that none of that mattered when you're talking about the vehicle, the trunk, and the unlocked suitcases. So the state would argue that he was did find the informant credible, reliable. He properly applied the facts up to the law in this case up until he reached the locked suitcase. And I think just the idea of it being locked is what tripped the trial court up in this area, is thinking that there was some extra protection afforded to that suitcase because it was locked in comparison to the unlocked one. Furthermore, exigent circumstances is determined by whether the facts viewed objectively would justify the issuance of a warrant, even though a warrant is not actually obtained. So, and I think taking the same consideration, especially when the trial court said how credible and reliable the informant was and the information regarding explosives, and back to your question, that it would have probably sufficed for a warrant, but even though we don't have a warrant in this case, exigent circumstances is determined by whether the facts did justify it, even though we didn't get one. And so I think under those facts that the trial court in this case improperly applied the facts of this case to the law as applied only to the locked suitcase. Additionally and alternatively, I would also argue that an exception to the warrantless search would be the inventory exception. The officers in this case obviously were going to be impounding the vehicle after the arrest of all of the men. Everyone that was involved in this gang membership were all arrested. No one was left to who could have taken responsibility of the vehicle. And the policy behind inventory searches is to protect the owner's property, to protect police from claims of theft, and to protect the police from potential danger. In this case, as a means of protection against possible future claims of theft of property from the trunk, an inventory is also proper if the keys to the trunk are located in the vehicle. So that alone would also get the officers not only in the vehicle, but also to the trunk of the vehicle. And although it's reasonable for officers to inventory locked containers, when the key to unlock the container is located within the car, and it is reasonable for officers to inventory a locked container if the key is available and therefore the contents of that locked container are accessible. In this case,
Ms. Simmons?
Yes, Your Honor.
You have looked at, I know, the Defendant's Exhibit 1 that's attached as an exhibit to the appellee's brief that purports to give us the portions of the stated policies of the Sheriff's Department in Denton County in terms of vehicle impoundment and vehicle activities in terms of proprieties of the impounding and searching of the vehicle. Do you acknowledge that those are accurate and that they do not contain any provision that specifically addresses locked trunks or locked items within the trunks of a car?
From what I remember when I first looked at this, that I would agree that this is a true copy of the policy and that I did not see anything regarding those items either, other than in the Texas law, Texas state law, though, is to the opposite. I mean, it says that we can inventory those items, and I would argue that the state law would overrule any inconsistency in a Denton County policy, police procedure policy,
Thank
for
you.
Impoundment.
In opposing counsel's conclusion, he says that the contents of the trunk should be suppressed as a matter of law. Do you perceive that we're here on that also, or are we only here on whether or not the contents of the container in the trunk should be suppressed?
We're only here as to the contents of the container of the vehicle. It's the state's appeal, interlocutory appeal, and that was the appeal, that was the only issue that was raised. And so I would argue that that's the only thing that, and his brief, majority of his brief reply is a response to my argument. I see that I'm getting close to running out of time. So in summation, I would argue that probable cause for the search at issue in this case existed because of the facts and circumstances that were in the knowledge of the officers at the scene regarding the possibility of explosives, of which they had reasonably trustworthy and credible information that they were going to find explosives in this vehicle. And additionally, alternatively, the trial court was correct in finding that officers had a right to conduct an inventory search of the vehicle based on the facts of this case, but he improperly applied the facts of this case to the law relating to a locked suitcase. Even though less intrusive alternatives may exist, the inventory under Texas state law was still reasonable. And I would request that the court reverse the trial court's order granting the motion to suppress regarding the locked suitcase.
Thank you, Ms. Simmons.
Hey, please the court. Mick Meyer for Mr. Ross, and to answer some of the justice's previous queries, yes, Mr. Ross is currently in the Denton County Jail awaiting trial on the merits of this case, and we're only here today because he's been delayed his day in court because the state has chosen to have what they're calling an interlocutory appeal. Justice McCoy, to answer your question, it's the defense's, the appellee's proposition that the police should have never been in the trunk, much less in a locked suitcase in the trunk. And to answer the question that you initially asked opposing counsel, was there any talk of a warrant? There was definite talk of a warrant, and it was brought up during the motion to suppress because the lead agent on it, Jeff Davis, was asked the question, well, did you guys ever talk about getting a warrant? And I'm talking from the third reporter's record, page 187. It's cited on page 7 of Appellee's brief. And Jeff Davis admits that, yes, indeed, we've talked about getting a warrant. But did you ever get one? No. So to correlate that with Justice Meyer's query about how long was this been going on, well, David Scott, who was working on the case with Jeff Davis, had met the so-called snitch informant, first-time informant for David Scott, 6 days earlier, and had been conducting intel and investigation into the matter all throughout the entire course, but never thought about securing a warrant, never even attempted to get a warrant. So with regard to the queries of what why didn't they do that? Jeff Davis answered it, we talked about it, we just never did it. But then what the state does when they come before you is now all of a sudden they want to bite off on this for this community safety standard, exigent circumstances, and particularly explosive bombs. Why? Because it's sexy, and in 2009, all of us get chills up our spine when we hear the word explosives or bombs. David Scott testified at length in federal court concerning the exact matters that were before Jake Collier at the time of the motion to suppress, and he never, ever once, ever mentioned the word explosives. But now, in order to create this fictitional exigent circumstances based on explosives, he testified it time and time again at the motion to suppress. The exigency in this particular case, they can't go off on saying that, well, it could be a search incident to arrest because luckily for Appellee in this particular case, the Supreme Court came down with Gantt. And it was right during the time period of all this. But I can guarantee you if the Supreme Court would not have decided Gantt, they would be standing before you saying, well, alternatively, the trial court was also wrong on this ground. Alternatively, they were wrong on this ground. The bottom line was you have four individuals, one of which who was a first-time informant for David Scott, arrested in a Walmart parking lot, an area that they'd already searched out and deciphered to be a safe area to make an arrest. Why? Well, because on the one hand, David Scott is saying if there was any type of gun battle, we didn't want any of the potential public to be disturbed. Judge Collier picked up on that when he decided the case and said, hey, wait, this was in a safe area. You already decided as much during your investigation into the case. But yet they take everybody down. There was nothing precluding them from getting a warrant besides the fact they were going to search that car. As pointed out in the statement of facts in the brief that I wrote to you guys, they brought two crime scene technicians, not for purposes of the tactical unit, for purposes of processing the car, and they did all this without a warrant. They never sought a warrant. They never even attempted to get a warrant. They go out there on the scene with the sole intention, we're taking everybody down and we're going to search everything that we can find. As far as the inventory, from all the seminal cases decided on down in Appellee's brief, and specifically the Opperman, Lafayette, Bertine, and Florida versus Wells, If you're going to conduct some type of inventory search for a vehicle, do it pursuant to standard routine procedures. Texas has gone even further and say, hey, have it in written format. That's something that Judge Collier also pointed out when he decided the case, because he said, hey, I've reviewed everything that Denton County has, and this was introduced at the motion to suppress by Appellee. It was introduced by the state. In fact, it was pointed out to the witnesses put up by the state, you guys didn't even fill out an vehicle impoundment registration that you're mandated to do pursuant to your own agreement. Well, we think we did. We're not sure if we did. We might have done that, but we certainly don't have it. If they don't have it before Judge Collier, he is in no position to decide whether or not they've met their burden of acting pursuant to standard written procedure. Furthermore, as Judge Collier points out, there's nothing about getting into a trunk, much less a locked suitcase found within a trunk, that's contained within the written standard procedure mandated by the Denton County Police Department. So the Denton County Sheriff's Office has a provision in place that doesn't even address the ideas. So if you don't have a written format, in written format, any type of procedure, you could never live up to, from the Supreme Court all the way on down through the Texas cases decided, any adherence to any type of written procedure because they don't exist. So for these reasons, I'm asking this court to, yes, indeed, if the court sees fit that what was found, the police shouldn't have been in that trunk, inure that benefit to the appellee in this case. Because I still stress, I put it in my brief, and I will still answer any question concerning that, I do not believe the police had the legal authority to be in the trunk, much less to the locked suitcases found within the trunk.
Mr. Meyer, the response in the appellee's brief is directly responding to the state's sole point of error in the case. And the state's sole point of error in the case is that the lower court erred in granting the motion to suppress the inquiry as to what was included in the locked suitcase. How do we get to, in terms of our appellate position, anything dealing with the court's ruling on the trunk?
Because when they ask you to reopen a case as an interlocutory appeal where there's been no finality because we haven't been able to go to trial on the merits of the case yet, therefore the trial court is in the position of awaiting the decision from the Court of Appeals. The state is the one that in this particular matter has chosen to take this up on a non-finality basis, and which was pointed out at the beginning of the brief, they say it's of substantial importance, but they put nowhere in their briefs as to why it constitutes substantial importance to their case. And so for the proposition of waiver, I'd submit that they should be poured out just as any type of appellant on their own after they've had a trial on the merits would be poured out on preservation of error. But with regard to your specific question, Justice Meyer, if this court does not see that the legal mechanisms were in place that the police should have ever been in the trunk, shouldn't those protections go to Ernest Lynn Ross when he does stand trial on the merits of the case? They're only wanting to try to get into locked trunk. Why? I mean, excuse me, locked suitcases. Why? Because the trial court, with all due respect, erroneously in eyes of Appellee, has allowed police access into the trunk. But I still stand by the proposition the police should have never been in the trunk. They should have never been in locked suitcases found within the trunk. And for those reasons, if the court were looking to explore disturbing the trial court's decision, shouldn't they disturb it on the grounds of they should have never been in there legally? Therefore, not only do we uphold the finding of not looking in locked suitcases in the trunk, but the police should have never been in the trunk in the first place.
My concern is just whether you've raised that issue without a cross point on the question about the trunk by stating in your summary of Appellee's argument and your response to the sole point of error that you're directing the inquiry as to the warrantless search of a locked suitcase found within the trunk as opposed to entry into the trunk by itself. I'm just concerned as to where we are as an appellate court and as to whether we have anything to rule on other than the suitcase.
And I understand your question, but in the prayer of the appellee's brief, it is requested that in the event that this were to be disturbed, the trial court ruling was to be disturbed, appellee is respectfully requesting that this court suppress any items found in the trunk, but alternatively, if Appellee prays that the court affirm the trial court's judgment at the least.
And, Mr. Meyer, you mentioned the federal court matter. Tell us about that. What was involved in federal court? And what was the occasion for Officer First and the Deputy Scott to be testifying in federal court at all?
David Scott has been cross-designated through the federal circuit and through the Denton County Sheriff's Department to where he works state and federal cases. When Ernest Lynn Ross was originally arrested, the federal government took over prosecution of unlawful possession of a firearm case. Denton County did not dump their state cases, but now they're simultaneously prosecuting him for two unlawful possession of a firearm case by a felon, as well as a conspiracy. Engaging in organized crime with conspiracy to commit aggravated robbery case. The trial in the federal circuit obviously comes up much quicker than in state courts, or I should say for most part in North Texas, the federal cases on the merits will come up much quicker than state cases do. At the time that David Scott testified in the federal court, he was testifying on the guns that were found at the scene for the unlawful possession of a firearm by a felon case that was being prosecuted in the federal district courts, the Eastern District in Sherman, for the exact matters that Jake Collier was then presented as one of the cases, as well as two more cases that the state is currently prosecuting Mr. Ross on.
So those cases have been tried?
The unlawful possession of a firearm case, which I believe was only one matter, was tried in the Eastern District, yes, sir. I don't know of any type of engaging in organized crime with conspiracy to commit aggravated robbery in the federal realm.
Thank you, sir.
Any other questions? And the unique question that you do ask me, Justice Meyer, is when I sat down to write Appley's brief as to whether or not designated as a cross point, raise it in some other fashion, all's what I know is that it's uncommon to be sitting at this table as an appellee, especially in an interlocutory fashion. All's what I'm looking for is that Ernest Lynn Ross get his day in court, and I'll be it as fair as possible. So with regard to the decisions that have to be levied in this case, I wrote the appeal with the prayer in mind of I don't want to give up anything with regard to the police being in the trunk, period, but albeit they shouldn't be in a locked suitcase found in the trunk when everybody's apprehended on the scene.
I understand. You're preserving that issue for presentation at a time of trial as well as on any subsequent appeal of whatever might happen at the trial.
Yes, sir.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'd first like to start off in response to counsel that the state argues exigent circumstances and hangs on that on the facts of explosives so much in this case, because it's a big fact in this case that played an important role in what the officers at the scene of this bust were dealing with, what the unknown was to them and what they had reliable, credible facts pertaining to, and them protecting not only themselves but also the people within that area of the Walmart parking lot. And I know that counsel has pointed out that we were in a fairly safe area because it was on a side wall or a back wall, I believe, of the Walmart. And the state would argue that still is not going to limit any kind of harm that could have occurred. We're still not going to know what type of explosives they were, what kind of harm they're going to cause. And the officers' lives are also still at risk at that point. If there is explosives and they're not allowed in these exigent circumstances that are involved in this case to act on that to protect themselves.
Well, don't we have a problem, though, because it seems to me that maybe the trial court's findings are inconsistent. In other words, the trial court declared all witnesses to be credible, but really his finding of fact about the concern for explosives tells me that he then decided that that really wasn't a true concern for the officers on the scene, or they would have gotten the bomb squad out there.
I agree and disagree kind of in the same breath, and it is inconsistent. The judge's holding on this motion to suppress is very inconsistent, and he begins by stating that the informant is credible and reliable. I find him credible, reliable, and he says it's pertaining to firearms and explosives. And the reliability of that confidential informant is what he relied upon to get him in the vehicle, to get them into the trunk, and into the open suitcases. And I really think that the only time he started to waver was when he had this locked container, that he suddenly felt that it had risen above the exigent circumstances realm. He obviously had the correct standard in mind when he found the other searches to be proper. He made the finding on the reliability and credibility of the informant, as well as what the officers knew at the time and the exigent circumstances, but then failed to follow that through on the very last piece of evidence And I truly think that it probably has to do with the fact that that container was locked and he somehow elevated the importance or the privacy interest in that container in comparison to the other containers. And I would just argue that because of the exigent circumstances, that's if those are found credible and reliable informant, credible, reliable information, and it's exigent, that it's going to carry all the way through and that the trial court faltered when it hit the locked suitcase area.
Seems to me there's a conflict there, and that if he believed really that there were explosives and guns or whatever in the vehicle, that they would be more likely to be found in a locked container in a locked trunk, not less.
Absolutely. I think that it was just the fact that it was locked is what seemed to catch him up on that area. And I see that I'm getting close to running out of time. I also just wanted to respond quickly to a couple of other things that counsel said. First, I would argue that Gantt does not apply because of the exigent circumstances. And here we're not speaking about a search incident to arrest. And second, counsel said that the agent's presence at the scene, some of the agent's presence was for the sole purpose of inventorying the vehicle. I would argue that's completely speculation. Remember anything in the record, and I'll ask the court to look at that, whether there's any testimony in the record that Denton County brought officers in specifically to search a vehicle without a warrant. And also, he talked about how Judge Collier had said that this was not a proper inventory search. On volume four at page 4, Collier said that this was a proper inventory search and then followed through and faltered there only at the locked container. If this court doesn't have any further questions, I would just ask the court to please reverse to the trial court on the motion to suppress the evidence in the locked suitcase only.
Thank you for your argument, and your case is submitted. Thank you very much.